Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 2nd of April. We're going to be talking about the issue of pay ratios. It's the latest front in a worldwide debate about inequality and the widening gap between the top 1% and everybody else. There are some interesting discussions taking place around the world. The European Commission in Brussels has a proposal under discussion that the European Union's 10,000 listed companies reveal their pay ratios and allow shareholders to vote on whether they are appropriate. What is fair? What is good for business? Do you need to make a whole lot of money to keep your top executives in place? The interesting thing that's motivating all of this is the huge gap between those who are running companies and those who are workers in the companies. Last year, the 10 mostly high-paid chief executives in this country took home more than $100 million each, most of the rewards from shares or stock options. A survey of 2,225 American chief executives found pay had risen by 8.47%. At the same time, average American family income was $51,017, and that was little changed from the year before, and 9% less than its inflation-adjusted peak in 1999 of $56,080. Analyzing all of this for us with a good worldwide perspective, particularly a European Union perspective, because she is joining us from London, is Deborah Hargreaves. She wrote a piece, the opinion pages of the New York Times on March 29, Can We Close the Pay Gap? Chair of the Independent High Pay Commission, an independent inquiry into high pay and boardroom pay in the public and private sectors in the UK, former business editor of The Guardian, also worked at the Financial Times as news editor and financial editor, and was a foreign correspondent in Brussels and also in Chicago. Deborah, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello.
I read that number and I read it over and over. This widening gap is really a continually widening gap, and it is huge, isn't it?
It's extraordinary, yes, and I think most people find it quite hard to get their head around how that has happened.
Yeah, and explain to us, is it the same in Europe as it is in the United States, and is it the same in various European countries? We're seeing this widening gap?
We're seeing the widening gap everywhere. In the US, it's really, really pronounced, and the UK is not far behind. Other European countries, it hasn't been rising quite so quickly, and it started from a lower base anyway. So in Germany, it's not so big. But still, it is rising everywhere as inequality around the world goes up. And I think that's an area of great concern for a lot of people.
I think you wrote about Germany and how there's an interesting situation there. Can you tell us about the VW plant?
That's very interesting. Germany has a slightly different governance structure from the rest of the world. It has this two-tier board system, and that means the executives that run the company sit on one board, but then another board, which is called the supervisory board, oversees them and keeps their eye on them. And so this board is made up half of shareholders and half of employees who are elected by the workforce. And that sort of keeps an eye on the executives. It has the overall responsibility for setting pay for executives, but also for setting strategy as well. So it's very important, has quite a big influence. Last year, we did some interviews with people on those boards, employees and shareholders as well. And it was very interesting to see the debate that's developed around that, and the particularly around pay. And Volkswagen, who everyone in America must know, very big, successful car company, their chief exec was the highest paid executive in Germany. And yet the board, the supervisory board, the employees on it, felt that he was getting too much. They felt that his bonus targets were too easy to reach. They didn't realize how much money he would get under that plan. And it was a time of growing inequality in Germany, so the debate was going elsewhere in the economy about executives being paid too much. So the employee directors on the supervisory board voted for him to have a 25% pay cut, which you can imagine wasn't particularly popular.
I can imagine.
And it wasn't particularly popular with the shareholders to start with, but they did a lot of talking around this issue. They pointed out that the pay ratio for workers at VW was very large and growing larger, and that he'd already be earning 17 million euros even with this pay cut. So I think it was an argument that took place over a number of months, and in the end it was agreed and it was pushed through, and I think it stood as quite an interesting moment in German corporate history, because VW was making record profits at the time, so it wasn't as if the company was doing badly, but they just felt that he was being over-rewarded.
And did he quit or not?
No, he's still there. No, Martin Winterkorn. And this is one thing that the employee directors said to us when we did our interviews. You know, the executives, they talk about this global market for talent, for executives. And he's a very good car maker, Martin Winterkorn. He's German, he's very effective, and he runs the company well. But as one of the employee directors said to me, he's never going to run General Motors. You know, he's never going to go to the US and get a job, because he's very solidly German.
Right.
And that is his history and his life. So they felt, you know, that this, the fact that he might go elsewhere was really a bit overblown, and he's still there. And it was all done in a sort of spirit of agreement. He agreed to see his pay cut. So I think there is a precedent for this, and that's what we're saying. You know, it's hard to have these conversations with executives, and it's very sensitive. But there is, you know, the gap is growing too wide, and we try and make the business arguments against that gap and say companies would work more effectively with a lower pay gap. The economy would work better as well, because people would have more money to spend.
Right. I don't understand, Deborah. Maybe you have a better sense of this than I do, but my family is involved in reporting on baseball and heavily in the world of sports. And as you know, athletes are paid an inordinately high amount of money in this country. And I always argue with them, why don't you have a few people who say, listen, I can't possibly spend that kind of money, be it $17 million or $50 million or some of these Wall Street people who are making much more than that. It's ridiculous. I can't in my lifetime spend this kind of money. So why wouldn't you just say, I'm going to stay in a certain town and it's going to be my home, and even though I'm a free agent and I could go make twice as much money, $50 million somewhere else, who in the world cares? Why would you want to? I don't get it. Do you get that?
Well,
I don't get it.
It is to do with recognition, I think. These are very competitive people.
Oh.
When you interview them, they do say, well, you know, it's not about the amount of money as such, but it's kind of like competing with our peers. You know, they want to stand out, they want to do well. But also they talk about other reasons, other motivations for doing their jobs. The company's strategy is important to them. They want satisfaction from bringing people on, working as a team. It's not just all about money, but money is quite important. But then you sort of say to yourself, as any rational person would, how could you possibly spend that? And it is true, they don't spend it. You know, it tends to sort of accumulate, you know, as they invest in shares or they invest in houses in London. It pushes up house prices. But, you know, they don't sort of spend a lot of it on living as the rest of us would, because they've already got enough money.
Right.
But I think, you know, it's almost seen as a badge of recognition.
Hmm.
And in the US, you have a great example of someone who doesn't do that. Warren Buffett, who's not that far from where you're based, is he, in Omaha?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm expressing
no,
my
it's,
ignorance.
No, it's not too mine. Far. That was good, Deborah. You're close.
And he says, you know, he lives in the same bungalow where he grew up, and he says the same thing. You know, I don't spend all my money. I have very modest taste. So not all executives are like that. It's just become almost a bit of a competition between them as to who gets what package.
Yeah. You mentioned in the article the history of pay ratios in this country, and I think it's interesting to be reminded of what people have suggested.
Yes. Well, I mean, you look back 30 years and you see that the ratio is much lower. I mean, in the UK, 30 years ago, the ratio between the top director's pay and the workforce was about 14, 15 times. In the UK, it's now 130 times. In the US, it's much more than that. But the history of the past 30 years has seen inequality just getting ever greater. So we did have a sort of post-war period where inequality was going down, actually down quite rapidly, up to about the end of the 1970s, and then it really took off. And it's took off a lot in the last sort of 10 years. So we've, you know, it hasn't always been like this, so it can be tackled again. And this is where some of these ratios are coming back in, you know, where the Swiss, for example, they have a direct democracy. So if you can get a number of people to sign a petition, you can have a referendum on it. And last year in November, they had a referendum about reducing pay ratios to 12 to 1. Now, that would be very, very challenging to get down to that level. And a few big companies threatened to leave the country if that happened. But it's still got 35% of support, so there's a lot of people behind that. Mm-hmm. So people are looking to history to see, you know, where the ratios have been in the past and to try and find some kind of level that they feel is appropriate.
George Orwell, you write, advocated a limitation of income so the best paid would earn no more than 10 times the lowest paid. Did people think that was a crazy idea in 1941?
That was in the sort of hectic period of the war, where he was trying to write a manifesto for a more fairer society after the end of the war. And he, it's quite interesting, actually, because one of the union leaders in the UK had mentioned this to me many months ago, and I'd forgotten about it. And he recently found the book and sent me the copy. So I've now actually got a copy of the book with this essay in it. And it has a lot of ideas which are considered incredibly radical now. So, for example, he's suggesting abolishing the private schools in the UK. In the UK, private schools are the paid-for schools, the ones that people have to pay a lot of money to send their children to. So he recommends abolishing them. It's quite a radical manifesto. And even he says a little bit later on, 10 to 1 is probably quite difficult to achieve and may not be quite as rigid as I've suggested. But I think people have said, you know, that kind of ratio needs to be an aspiration. You know, we need to be sort of aiming for something a lot lower rather than seeing these ratios go ever higher.
Is there, and I wonder if this varies from country to country, is it easy for you as a reporter to get information about what the pay differential is between the bosses and the workforce?
No, it's quite difficult because companies don't want to disclose that information. And we've seen a huge argument in the U.S., actually, in the Dodd-Frank Act that came in after the financial crisis, had a stipulation in there that companies should produce their pay ratios. But that met a lot of corporate opposition. And this was just to disclose the ratio, not to lower it or anything, just to disclose
it.
And the SEC has spent 5 years trying to write a rule that will allow companies to disclose that, and it still hasn't really come in. And it's the same in the UK. There was a suggestion last year that we should companies should disclose pay ratios, but there was a huge amount of opposition to it. This new recommendation from the European Commission is seen as very controversial, and this is to say that companies should produce their pay ratio, and then shareholders should vote on it as to whether it's appropriate or not. Now, companies really hate that idea. And I think, you know, the sensitivity around pay is such that high pay for those at the top has gone on rising really, really sharply, even since the financial crisis, whereas no one else in the workforce has really seen a pay rise. You know, people in the US and in the UK and a lot of Europe are not getting pay rises that keep up with inflation, so they're falling behind the whole time. So that pay gap is getting ever bigger.
I'm surprised, Deborah, that there aren't many more people who are very upset about that.
There are people who are upset, but a lot of them feel they don't have a voice. And that's why it's important for organizations like ours to make that argument, because we face a very, very strong vested interest in the corporate sector. They really don't want anything to change. And they have a lot of money to invest in PR and in marketing so that they can argue against us. And we're a very small organization. There's only three of us, but we have managed to attract some funding, and we have been quite successful in that. And we make a very strong argument. And because I'm a former reporter, I still have good connections with the press, so we do get quite a lot of coverage. And we do get a lot of sympathy and a lot of support from the public. It's just that people feel they're powerless to do anything about it. And we go out to companies quite a lot, actually. We talk to groups of people who work in big companies. And the discussion is a very sensible one. You know, these people, they will say, well, we feel that the boss needs to be rewarded well because he works hard, he works long hours and, you know, lots of responsibility. We wouldn't want that job. But they sort of say, well, you know, we think 10 or 20 times what we earn is appropriate, you know, not hundreds of times. And so I think people aren't saying that they want everyone to be on the same pay. They're saying, you know, there needs to be different levels of pay. It's just that the big differentials have got out of hand.
Well, let's see what the Midwest audience has to say about your thoughts here, and we'll welcome a phone call. Zebra Hargreaves is our guest, and she is an interesting person. She's the former business editor of The Guardian, and she's written extensively about executive pay and other business issues, both in print and also online, and we found out about her through a March 29 opinion pages of the New York Times. She's chair of the Independent High Pay Commission, which is an independent inquiry into high pay and boardroom pay in the public and private sectors in the UK, but she obviously knows a lot about what's going on in the United States. She was a foreign correspondent in Brussels and also in Chicago. Should this information be made public? Does it make businesses better if you really pay CEOs very well because they're responsible for businesses, ultimately for businesses being effective? Or does it make workers who are making a whole lot less money wonder what the heck's going on here? Would it be better if workers were paid more? Would it be better for the economy? Just a few of the questions we're entertaining this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, we're so modern, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Debra Hargreaves, our guest, and our first caller is Ruth in Madison. Hi, Ruth.
Mine is more of a comment than a question. It isn't so much the ratio for me as to where they get the money. So many times a new, like there'll be a takeover of a company and the new CEO gets, they raid the pension, you know, which is the deferred wages of the workers, the deferred compensation. They raid that and they give it to the new CEO and the shareholders, and that's not their money. They steal it.
Deborah?
Yes. Well, I think also it's the way they're paid, because taking over companies is a way of raising your share price, which is, of course, where a lot of the CEOs get their money from. They're paid in shares. But that's a very short-term effect. And actually taking over other companies is really detrimental for almost everyone else connected with the company. So lots of people lose out. They lose their jobs. Even in the long run, shareholders don't do too well out of it because most mergers don't really work. And so, yes, it's right. Where does the money come from? And how are they paid? And they do take a very short-term outlook on things. They can't raid the pension fund in the UK because it's been made illegal since we had a really big scandal over pension fund raiding several years ago. But I didn't realize that was happening in the U.S., and if it is, it's pretty appalling.
Thank you very much, Ruth, for your call. Kurt in Chippewa Falls, hi.
Hi. Apart from the immorality of the inequity, it seems to me that the what's going on is the income money that should be in the general economy is being redistributed to a very few and taken out of the economy, which is, you know, bad for everything. And it seems to me the simplest way to deal with this is through the United States tax code. Tax anything and everything that can be construed as value, being the CEOs receiving value from their corporations, and tax it as ordinary income. It would then become impractical to redistribute such wealth to the few. And it would stay in the corporations, perhaps go to more research, development, wages, improved products and services, or what have you.
Yes, I completely agree with that. I think that giving so much income to those at the very top, as I was saying before, they don't really spend it in the productive economy. They invest it. And in a way, it has a bad effect on all the rest of us in the long term when they invest in things like food futures, commodity futures, pushing up food prices. And so, you know, their investments at the very top end, and then a lot of this money is just hoarded. So it's not being recirculated. It's not being spent in the economy, and it is, as you say, being taken out. Tax rates, incredibly controversial. I'm very
yes.
interested to hear that there's an argument in favor of raising taxes in the U.S. because we're always told here that, you know, we've got to create a low-tax economy, we've got to be like the U.S., and we have to lower our taxes. We've just reduced the tax. Our government here has reduced the tax from a tax on top rate of incomes and brought it down from 50% to 45%. And that caused quite a lot of anger and discussion here because it's met, you know, it's seen as being a tax on bankers, and this was taken off by the government here, and people feel that wasn't fair. There are lots of people losing out at the bottom of our economy because we've had a lot of cuts in public spending and a lot of cuts in support for welfare. And at the same time, the government is seen to be sticking up for bankers and highly paid people by lowering taxes on them. So, yes, I fully agree with you that we should have higher taxes.
What you just said, though, people will say, are you kidding me? 50 to 45% when we in this country have had presidential candidates who evidently were paying something like 15%.
Yes. Yes, I realize it's much lower there.
Much.
I mean, it's higher in the rest of Europe. So we're slightly between. Our top rate is coming down, but obviously it's still higher than in the U.S.
Yeah. I know that you have done work in Chicago and have lived in the States for a while, but you primarily have a U.K. worldview
yeah.
of this. But
yeah.
it's interesting to me in this country, and I'm wondering if in your country it's the same. I think there still is this strong belief that, you know, this Horatio Alger only doubled the dream by 100 million times I could be that rich, too. Don't
yeah.
cut off their pay because one of these days I'm going to make it.
Yes, there is that feeling. We don't have that quite so much in the UK.
Right.
And that was, I lived in Chicago a long time ago. So my son was born there and he's now working in the States. He's working in Miami.
Oh.
And he's now 25. So
oh.
he was born in Chicago. So it shows you how long ago I lived there. But that was one of the things that we really enjoyed about the US was a sort of can-do spirit and this feeling that you could make it if you wanted to. You know, the feeling that you could almost do anything. I mean, I was right at the beginning of my career then. It was a very exciting time to be in the U.S., but I feel that over the years that's changed and that it's become much more difficult to pursue the American dream. I do feel that there's quite a lot stacked up against people now, and particularly here in the U.K., social mobility has really gone down in recent years. It's worse now than it was in the 1960s. And so we feel that, you know, we're going backwards in the UK. And I feel that those same trends are in place in the US, too.
Thank you, Kurt. David in Wisconsin Rapids, you're next. Hi.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and good afternoon to your guest. I wonder if your guest is familiar with a book that was published last year called What Went Wrong, and it's written by a man by the name of George R. Tyler, T-Y-L-E-R. People can Google that and learn more about the book. But He describes this process and where it started, and he goes back to the 40s, right after World War II, when the gold, what he calls the golden years, started. Back then, there were tax rates as high as 80 and 90%, and there were millionaires. There were a lot of millionaires generated even at that tax rate. But he points out, beginning in the late 70s and actually beginning with Reaganomics and deregulation and appointment to the National Labor Relations Board of anti-union people, and he spells it out in chapter and verse with charts and graphs. It's such a story of greed, and these people, these corporate CEOs with their interlocking boards of directors and their control over the board, have practically a license to steal. And if that's not an offshore employment and so forth, and if that's not bad enough, they take this income and put it offshore somewhere. So our government as badly as we need the revenue for the problems that we have, they're hiding a lot of this money offshore. The same thing goes for Wall Street. I just encourage anyone who has a strong feeling about this to read George R. Tyler's book. It's called What Went Wrong.
What Went Wrong. Thanks, David. Deborah?
Yes, well, I don't know that book, but I will certainly look it up now that you mentioned it. And it's right. I mean, in the late 70s, inequality really did take off with Reaganomics. And Margaret Thatcher, of course, in the UK, was a great follower of Reaganomics, and she liberated the UK economy. And those reforms have led almost directly to what we've got now, because there were lots of changes that enabled people to become, well, more greedy, really. This whole era of greed is good became almost fashionable, and that's led to hugely rising inequality. And it all dates back to that. But, you know, we can turn it round. And I do think that if enough of us are angry enough, we can do things.
Thanks for the call. You write that there is a growing chorus of voices in Britain arguing for the election of employees onto company boards or remuneration committees. Is that happening at all in Britain? We mentioned what happened with VW. Is it happening in Britain?
No, it's very unpopular again with the corporate sector. But we have an election coming up next year, and it's become a discussion point around certain election issues. And the Labour Party, which is not in power at the moment, but has been quite high in the polls, it's been slipping lately, but it is looking at issues around changing the way companies are run, and is looking at issues around high pay and certainly changes to enable workers to sit on boards. We only have one company in the UK that has a worker on the board, one big company, and they are very in favour of it, and they have spoken in favour, but no other companies have actually followed that lead. But there could be, under a new government, if it's a Labour government or if it's a coalition with the Liberal Democrats, there could be rules to be brought in that would make companies have their workers on boards, have elected workers on the boards. I think that might change quite a lot of the debate about some of this stuff.
So this would have to happen, Deborah, at the level of Parliament?
Yes, it would. Companies could do it now if they wanted to. Uh-huh. And there was some discussion last year. The government brought in a new bill to give shareholders more power to vote on pay. And there was some discussion then about whether workers should be on boards and remuneration committees. And we were advocating that very strongly, us as a group. But that was defeated by the corporate lobby. And for some reason, a lot of executives seem to be slightly fearful of talking to their own workforce on an equal level, and that's something that I just can't understand. Because I think you go into most companies and you talk to anyone who works there, they all know where the problems are, and they mostly know how to fix them as well. And having those sorts of people on your company board who would really help to open up the strategy discussion to the rest of the workforce, I think could make the company work really well, and has had a very good effect in Germany. But a lot of corporate bosses really do not like that idea.
We have a couple lines open right now. 800-486-8655 is the number. Our lines have been very busy. Our guest this hour is Deborah Hargreaves, and we're talking about the pay of CEOs of companies in her part of the world and also our part of the world here, and how that gap is growing more and more and more, asking whether it's good for business to do that and if it's good for a country's economy to have that kind of gap, and why we do have that kind of gap. She's director of the London-based campaign group, the High Pay Center. She is a journalist. She has worked for the Financial Times and for The Guardian, and was a foreign correspondent in Brussels and also in Chicago. More phone calls. Let's go to Carl in Madison next. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Kathleen, and thank you, Ms. Hargreaves, for raising an issue that I think these are things that we all learned in kindergarten, to look out for one another, to share and share alike. And if we actually embrace them as adults with the problems we could solve in this world. There was a study that was recently associated with NASA that focused on the issues facing the world right now, and what the likelihood, what the threats are for complex society collapse. And they look back in time to the Han civilization, to the ancient Roman civilization, to Mesopotamian civilizations that were complex societies, and they eventually collapsed. And they looked for what were the commonalities in the collapse of these civilizations. And, of course, there were the usual factors of famine or drought. But then there was one striking factor that was true of all of these different societies, and that was the increasing distance between the wealthiest and the poorest in those communities, where those at the top began to take more and more and actually created such great distance between them and the workers who served them that they had no idea what was going on in the fields. They didn't use resources wisely. And soon the people at the bottom were dying off in droves, and the rich were so isolated from them that they had no idea that their own society was in chaos and collapsing. And then they followed the poor, and it all fell apart. And this study looked at that long-term history of these different societies that have existed over time and compared it to where we are right now, and had very grave concerns about this wealth inequality that faces the nation and the world.
Deborah.
Yes, Carl, I read that study as well, and I thought it's very interesting. And I really do think it's kind of interesting the way they highlight this issue of inequality, where people don't realize what's going on in the rest of their society. And we already see that to some extent. And I talk to quite a lot of audiences of top executives and top bosses, and some of them display a real insensitivity to the way other people live. Mm. And when you say things like, you know, people find it very hard to survive on the minimum wage nowadays, and people are going to food banks where they're getting free food because they can't afford to feed their families, which I think as a society we should be ashamed of. And those top executives, I don't think they ever come into contact with anyone like that. They have no idea what it's like to live on low wages. They don't even really come into contact with their own workforce, let alone anyone who's in a worse position. And I think some of them just do not see what's going on out there. And I think that's a very dangerous situation for us to be in. And at our peril, we ignore this. You know, I think there are people at the bottom of society who are really struggling and are not being understood, you know, are not, their voices aren't being heard. And I really think, you know, it's not a good development for anything, social stability or even, you know, economic stability. Even the IMF, which is generally much in favor of all these free market things, has pointed out that inequality is holding back growth because people haven't got any money to spend.
Isn't it hard to believe, though, that you can have those kinds of blinders on, Deborah? Because don't you read the news? Don't you see the newspapers? Don't you have an idea of what's going on in the world? How can you be so blind?
I wonder if you just don't want to see it. I mean, sometimes I think people just want to believe what they see in their own sort of scenario and they have in their own setup. And they may come into contact with people who work for them but who have a sort of interest in, you know, not highlighting what's going on in their own lives, and they don't, you know, these very powerful people don't tend to take much interest in other people's lives. As long as they've done a job for them, they tend to move on, and they mix socially with lots of people who are similar to them and live in similar backgrounds and live in similar areas. They don't mix outside their own small areas. And I just wonder whether it's the sort of, it's a blindness which people are willingly having. You know, people just don't want to see it because it would threaten the way their own life is set up and threaten the way they feel. And when I was a reporter, I used to go to investment banks in the City of London quite often to interview people. And I had a lift with one of them once who had a chauffeur to take us across London. And I thought, actually, living in London is such a different experience if you have lots of money.
Yes, right.
Because you never have to go on the tube where it's so overcrowded, and right, you don't have to use any of the public services which are really struggling for money. So you maybe you don't see these things. I don't know. I'm not rich, so
thank you, Carl, for bringing our attention to that, and we'll follow through on that. That would be an interesting show down the road. Ryan in Oshkosh. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to thank you for having the show. Your guest is so well informed, as my new personal hero. I think the thing is, for the common person, these issues, I guess like you already said, are so complex and shrouded in mystery that they can't be grasped by the average person with so much distraction in their life. And there's a band called Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum, and they have a song called The Creature that's all about this. And I think it's the number one pressing issue of our time, how this hyper-elitist class has been formed, and they definitely have the wheel of the machine.
Thanks for the call. Well, it may sound complicated, but at some levels, it's pretty glaringly simple, isn't it, Deborah?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's all about reward and greed, essentially.
Right.
And I think the thing is, there's a lot of sort of pseudoscience around the way people organize these pay schemes and the way these top executives are paid. So they are, you know, saying, well, this is all experts have advised us on this, that this is the way to pay, and we need these targets, and we need to work to these measures. And a lot of it is not really very meaningful at all, but it's all dressed up in a very sort of complex language, which makes it sound scientific and important and the right thing to do. And I just think actually changing the language on that would be a good start, because a lot of the issues are not complex, but they're made to seem complex. And as a former journalist and reporter, I always think that you have to explain things in an accessible way, but it's not in anyone's interest, if they're earning all this money, to say, well, actually, I'm getting it because I'm worth it, and that's it, you know.
I'm worth it, yeah. What a mindset. Thanks very much for the call, Ryan. We'll take more in just one moment. Here's how you can reach our conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is Deborah Hargreaves, chair of the Independent High Pay Center. And she wrote a piece, Can We Close the Pay Gap?, in the March 29th issue of the New York Times, which is on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And she looks at the latest front in a worldwide debate about inequality and the widening gap between the top 1% and everyone else. And that issue is pay ratios. And that's what we are talking about. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go back to phone calls for Deborah, and Linda in Fish Creek is next. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good.
I'm enjoying this discussion very much. I have worked in the area of executive pay for many years. I no longer really do, but understand the process pretty well, I think, and often gritted my teeth through particular incidents. Having worked as with consultants in this area to corporations. My question in general has to do with methods that Ms. Hargreaves touched on briefly, such as that going on in the UK right now, to change the composition of boards of directors. In my experience and to my knowledge, in U.S. public corporations, the ultimate decision makers over executive pay are compensation committees, which are essentially committees of half a dozen to a dozen people of the board. They generally look like the senior executives and are like the senior executives, often coming from other public companies. And they are advised, as Ms. Hargreaves was just saying a few minutes ago, by experts, and they act like it's very complex when it doesn't really have to be. And we've had in our country a system where for 20 or so years, the main point of attack in any organized way on excessive executive pay has been through disclosure, SEC rules saying you must disclose this, you must disclose that, and it's not working. And it seems to me the only thing that really could work is without things that just won't be acceptable in the U.S., such as mandatory pay ratios or mandatory dollar maximums on comp, is to really change the composition of boards and specifically compensation committees so that there is representation from workers and or other kinds of people. Academics, for example, are grossly underrepresented on public boards. So I'm wondering, after all this, I'm sorry if I'm over-talking.
No, it's good to know all this.
About Ms. Hargreaves' reaction to these things.
Yes, thank you. Thanks so much for your call.
Yeah. Hi, Linda. It's interesting that you've worked in this area for some time, and as you said, gritted your teeth on certain occasions. But the setup in the UK is the same as in the US. So we have what we call remuneration committees, which is a committee of the board which sets the executive pay. And again, they are advised by remuneration experts, all of whom come from very similar backgrounds. These remuneration committees, again, are made up of non-executive directors. They tend to come from very much the same background as the directors. They tend to know each other. We've called it a cozy club. There tends to be a lot of sort of groupthink. They all tend to agree with each other. People very seldom ask difficult questions about why big packages are being agreed and don't sort of point out very often that the rest of the workforce has another pay rise or that this pay gap is getting much bigger. And again, we have had increasing disclosure in the US, in the UK, sorry, the same as the US. That has been an area where governments have said you need to reveal more of your figures and show what's going on. But shareholders should be acting on this, and shareholders have a vote on pay and they can take action. They have tended not to, mainly because shareholders also sort of come from the same sort of background and or just aren't interested. Sometimes they hold the shares for a very short period or they're overseas shareholders. They're not that involved in what's going on in that particular country. So we have said that, you know, things aren't going to change unless there is a change in composition. And I agree with you. We need to get much more diverse boards, not just workers, but also other types of people, people who will come from outside this cozy club. Maybe you want customers on your board or suppliers or, as you say, academics, people with different life experiences and people who are prepared to talk up and prepared to challenge, and not just on pay, but on all sorts of other corporate items as well. You need to have people in there who are saying to the chief executive, who's often quite powerful, you know, is this the right thing for the company? Should you be going out and buying another company? Is that going to work for us in the long term? You know, these bosses need to be taking long-term decisions, and the board is there to help them do that. And so these boards need to have a much more diverse life experience. And so yes, Linda, I agree with you. We do need to get some change there. It is difficult to legislate for things like mandatory pay caps or mandatory pay ratios. Governments are very reluctant to do that. And my view is that you change the structures, you change the people who are talking about these things, and you can start to bring in change to the awards themselves.
Thanks very much for the call. Can you pinpoint a time, Deborah, when everything changed, when all of a sudden, or was it just a gradual increasing gap between those who work and those who run companies?
Well, it was more, for us in the UK, it was around the time of 1979 when we had the first election of Margaret Thatcher. She was elected for three terms, and she came in with a mission to change. I mean, she really wanted to shake things up, and she wanted to give, she wanted to take away union power, mm-hmm. Because there was a feeling in the 1970s that workers' unions were far too powerful and had too much impact on companies. And she wanted to privatize companies. She wanted to get them out of state control, give them free rein to do what they wanted to, and she felt to be much more entrepreneurial. And there were some good things that came in, but also some bad things. I mean, that was when inequality really started to take off, and it hasn't really looked back.
We go to Gloria in Lancaster. Hi.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I really believe that this is a very important topic. And if ever you want to do this again, you know, I would just really, really, I just would really appreciate it because it's such a very important topic. Because right now we don't have a living wage for people. And we need to have a living wage so that people don't have to have two or three jobs just to, you know, to live. And I think that the CEO is, because they're making so much money, is taking it away, and they're conniving all kinds of ways to keep it so that they continue to make so much money. But I think regulation very important, and one gentleman talked about the taxes. I thought that was kind of a good idea. I mean, because at one time the tax rate was talking about being 80% to 90%. I do believe that that's true, and I think it really is so fair. But how can we get back to this? How can we get it so that there's the ratio? Mm-hmm. I mean, do we have to have laws by our Congress to change it?
How does that happen, Deborah?
Well, yes. I mean, it is hard. You know, it is hard to get this done. We need to have some. Politicians do talk about this a lot. They tend not to do very much about it because they're a bit frightened of the corporate lobby. There's a very, very strong, powerful lobby of big businesses who don't want anything to change. So we've got to get some politicians who are confident enough and strong enough to stand up to them. But as we were talking to the last caller, to Linda, about changing the structure of these boards of directors so that you need to have different people who are making these decisions, people with a little bit more common sense on this sort of thing. And I agree with you. It's important. You know, there is no living wage. We have the same thing in the UK. And I think the reason why this debate has become so important to a lot of people in the UK is that they see themselves slipping down the income ladder. They mm-hmm. see themselves not being middle class anymore, and also they see their own children leaving college. Now we have to take out loans to go to college. It's still not as big as in the US, but it's a big deal for us in the UK because we didn't have to do that before, and so they're. The children are leaving college with great big loans to pay off, and they can't get a job, or they get a job where they're being paid very little. They have to carry on living at home because they can't afford to leave home. And I think people are seeing this among their own offspring and, mm-hmm. and feeling that it's not right that the people at the very top are getting all of the money.
Thank you very much, Gloria, for the call. How long has your current organization been around? Are you new, Deborah?
Oh, yes, we are new, yes. So it grew out of, as you mentioned before, I ran an independent high pay commission in 2010 to look at pay in the top 1%. And we came out with a report in November 2011 where we had recommendations for tackling it, and we were talking about the issue and the need to tackle it. So then I set up this the High Pay Centre, And we started at the beginning of 2012, so we haven't really been going for very long, but we have been very lucky in that it's become an important issue, and we've managed to get funding to keep ourselves going. And
right.
We're a fairly modest organization, but, you know, we're trying.
Well, you're doing well. Here you are in Wisconsin in the Midwest of the United States today, so that's good. Thank you very much. It was a really interesting conversation. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and it's been very good to talk to all of the callers. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very
good.
Much.
I'm glad you did. Our guest, Deborah Hargreaves, chair of the Independent High Pay Center, former journalist, still a journalist. She came to our attention through an op-ed piece. And we thank Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, the second hour of our show.